is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hayes.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, my friends. Welcome to another week. It is the Grahamian Report. I'm your happy host, Micah Hanks. Broadcasting to you from that dark disquiet known as the Mohorovic discontinuity, we have commandeered and occupied our own little dark corner of the web. And you visit us every week, Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. We're worldwide around the globe on the internet, joining this cultural phenom, which we call the Grahamian Report. Joining me in studio tonight is Caleb Hanks. Caleb, how are you this evening, my friend?
I'm great. Hello, all you listeners out there.
Tyler Pittman as well. Tyler, how are we doing there, bud?
Doing well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys, for being here with me. What a week for news. You know, I almost just want to say, okay, guys, fill me in. What's been happening? Of course, I'm a news hound just as well. We've got some news for you. In fact, we've got a great, big, brand new addition to the program that we're going to be launching tonight. So those of you listening tonight are going to be the very first ones who hear anything about this anywhere. We'll get to that a little later. But we're going to jump, for the time being, directly into news and get this show on the road. Or whatever it is that the mode of transportation which we utilize is. For all I know, it may be a ufological missile. To tease a little bit about what we're going to be talking about later in the program. Did you guys see this? Apparently Michael Jackson's secrets have now all been revealed. Yeah, that happened years ago. I remember the girl I was dating at the time that the death of pop singer Michael Jackson, the king of pop himself, had been announced. And of course, just today, we're hearing they're still trying to determine the actual cause of death. As I understand it, Michael Jackson's mother and his children, is this correct, are actually suing the company. I believe it's AEG Live. Because they feel that there was negligence on their part. They were going to be promoting the final, you know, tour or the program that they were going to be taking out. You can't really just call it a tour. I mean, Michael Jackson's live performances, of course, were well known for being cultural phenoms in their own right. So anyway, the jurors who are hearing the Michael Jackson wrongful death trial now have what is being described as a stark vision of the dead pop icon. After autopsy photos were released in the courtroom. But get this. Apparently, without getting into the gory details, much of what the jurors heard, they said, was a repeat of scientific evidence portrayed or presented in the trial of Murray, who, of course, Conrad Murray. This is the doctor who was apparently accused of the wrongdoing here. We'll get to that in just a moment, but this is just so bizarre. This is a program that talks about weird news, and I have to say, when I read this headline, it may seem inconsequential. It is pretty bizarre. Michael Jackson, interesting character, and they're saying that apparently the photos that were shown in court actually showed that he not only had his lips tattooed pink, but also that his eyebrows had been tattooed and that the front of his scalp had also been tattooed black in order to be able to blend in with the hairline for the wigs that he wore. Good grief. I mean, you know, and it's so funny because we always joke about, like, if you want to meet an alien, go to Walmart at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, Michael Jackson, he was a talented guy, and I'm not convinced he wasn't an alien. Very well may have been the case. Who knows? But, of course, his life was claimed all too early. Now, according to the Los Angeles coroner's toxicologist, Dan Anderson, who studied the drugs found in Jackson's body, he testified Monday and said that the level of propofol, I believe is the name of the substance found in Jackson's body, was consistent with major surgery anesthesia. Wow. That is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, to keep in mind with the hairline tattoo, he was severely burned. I believe it was in the late 80s.
Was it filming a Pepsi commercial?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Oh, goodness.
Something else you got to take into consideration, though. It's kind of weird that people look at Michael Jackson, they're like, well, he got his lips tattooed pink. That's so crazy. But there's people all over the world, females usually, that do tattooed permanent makeup.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, cosmetic tattooing, if you will. And, of course, you know, you have to wonder. I mean, it's funny because there is a ufological tie-in here. And there's a lot of, really, seriously, and we're going to be talking a good bit about UFOs tonight on the program, and hence my choice in opening with this story. You remember Michael Jackson had a cameo in one of the MIB films. Remember, you can call me Agent
yeah.
M?
Yeah, I remember
so,
that.
And it's funny because there are all these jokes about, oh, man, you know, toward the end of his life, he did look so strange. Maybe he was an alien. You know, I believe that Michael Jackson actually had interest in these sorts of subjects and things like that. And so in addition to, I guess, feeling that he was Peter Pan living in Neverland, but an altogether very strange set of affairs. And, of course, that was only further complicated and made even stranger by the release of that story. Speaking of weird medical situations, by the way, another one. This is talk about weird news for many people. Okay, who suffer from allergies, especially this time of the year. What if you found out that that runny nose that you had wasn't being caused by an allergy? This is precisely what happened to one man, Joe Nagy, who learned that year-round sinus problems he had been experiencing were actually due to a hole in his brain, which had been leaking fluid. Can you believe that? Doctors had to perform surgery to fix the problem. This clear liquid dribbled out of my nose like tears out of most people's eyes, Joe recalled. At one point, he says, about a teaspoon of liquid had splashed all over a set of airplane blueprints that he'd been working with. When allergy medication and a constant supply of tissues didn't seem to help, he turned to experts to find the cause. Leaking brain fluid caused by a tiny hole in his brain was found to be the cause. Truly bizarre. And for those of you, speaking of UFOs, that are looking to see one, many would tell you that the best place in the world that you can go right now probably is actually, I believe, only 5 hours from the Graylian bunker, none other than Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Our friends at Open Minds had actually spent a little time down there trying to understand the apparent nature of strange illuminations being seen in the sky over Myrtle Beach. As I also understand, there is a UFO, some sort of an attraction, they call this Encounters UFO Experience, that's actually opened there in Myrtle Beach. And besides this area's 14 million tourists, they hope that they can also maybe attract a few from, well, maybe not just other parts of the country or the globe, maybe from other parts of the universe just as well. Myrtle Beach is a hot spot for sightings, said Brian Bouquet of the Intergalactic Brands, apparently one of the companies associated with this. Now, according to WPDE News Channel 15, a quick check of websites like the Mutual UFO Network or the National UFO Reporting Center does show one report after another of sightings in Myrtle Beach or nearby Cherry Grove, Little River, and other localities nearby. Bill Barrett, who works a night shift at a Myrtle Beach oceanfront hotel, says he's seen many unexplained lights in the sky, often grouped together in some kind of formation. He says the geometry is perfect. They're perfectly spaced, perfectly level on the horizon, and they're probably about a mile and a half to 2 miles off the beach. Now, of the half-dozen sightings Barrett has witnessed over the years, the one that intrigues him the most and seems the hardest to explain was a giant orange oval, which he saw just last November. Some of you may have seen this on the news or on YouTube videos. It seemed to him to be dripping what he described as being a lava-like fluid. Now, when that happened, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I mean, explain that to me. What could that possibly be? Well, one UFO expert says Myrtle Beach doesn't necessarily get more UFOs than other places. He says the same kinds of sightings are happening all around the world, but that people on the Grand Strand, as they call it, seem to do a better job reporting, and maybe more people in Myrtle Beach are looking up. But who is this ufologist that they reference? Of course, everyone's favorite and a good friend of ours, Stanton Friedman. He says the willingness to report, investigate, and treat fairly, they've done a good job of that here in this town. Who lectured, Stanton did, on the flying saucers for the grand opening of this new UFO exhibit there in Myrtle Beach. He says from all over the world there are reports of flying objects that defy explanation and too many reports to simply dismiss. They're manufactured and they're not from here, and that means they're from someplace else. Of course, that's the kind of thing that Stanton in recent years has said, and he was last week in Washington, D.C., talking about that at the Citizens Hearing for Disclosure, which we discussed a good bit on the program. Just as well. You know, I don't know, though, if we can so easily say they're not from here, and therefore they must be from someplace else. I think half the time, part of the problem is trying to determine actually what these UFOs are. And we can't rule out the possibility that some of these things could be a technology from right here on Earth. You know, another news story that I saw today, and it's so widely discussed, I didn't feel like, trying to touch on it today, but I'll mention it very least. I believe the Pacific Standard carried it. It was a very long article about John Teeter, the time traveler. Do you guys remember John Teeter? This guy rose to fame about around, 2000, 2001. when he claimed that he had been a time traveler from like the 2030s, and he'd come back in time, and that he'd stopped by the year 2000 to see himself as a three-year-old child, and then he was going back to the 1970s to like claim some sort of like an IBM computer. This would have been like the old IBM computers that had like the wood paneling and the frame on them. Actually, those were some old Macintosh computers. Did you guys, do you remember those?
Oh, yeah. Did he build it into a TARDIS from Doctor Who?
Yeah. And he claimed that apparently, you know, self-aware computers basically take over in the future, I think was part of what John Titor had said. And that in essence, what he had done was that he had traveled back in time to get components from an old IBM computer, which was the only thing that wasn't capable of being compromised by the AI of the future. And this is the only way they could save the world, is to travel back in time and get components from an IBM computer that wasn't as technologically efficient as a calculator that you'd keep on your desk.
The only way to freedom was to play a level of Oregon Trail.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what's fascinating to me is, and of course I sat there, I read the entire article, that interest in the story. This guy starts posting on message forums. He allegedly posted a few images of, I think, the badge of the organization that he was actually with. Of course, like so many of these stories, whether it be in popular fiction or, you know, in these conspiracy theories regarding actual time travelers, the most famous of whom, not to say that there aren't others, but arguably the most famous has been John Titor, they would, you know, they would always make predictions. Okay. And some of the predictions that John Titor had made, of course, were that after 2004, there would be no more Olympics. Well, we see that one's bunk. And of course, he said that there would be a World War III in the imminent future. That's always seems to be the number one prediction that a time traveler is going to make, is that, yes, there's going to be a conflict. And not only is there going to be a world war, then there's going to be a war between us and them, the machines.
Why are these time travelers so negative?
It's always negative stuff. Yeah. But of course, after 2004, unless we're all living in a parallel time, you know, time warp or something like that, apparently we have continued to have Olympic ceremonies. Oh, but you know what? That's what John Titor said also. He says, now bear in mind, I'm going to tell you what happened in my reality, but there are, you know, alternative, you know, parallel times running, you know, adjacent to one another. And so my time, okay, that I traveled from, my universe, my dimension may not be the same as what history plays out for this one. That orb, the reason that we haven't experienced John Titor-esque time, future events, is because John maybe succeeded in whatever his mission was. Maybe he actually got back in time and managed to prevent those kinds of things from happening. So, John, maybe if you were successful, you did us all a favor.
Thanks, John.
For all we know, the guy actually was a bigger success than what we thought he was. When we come back, we'll get to a couple of listener emails, and we'll also touch on a couple of the hot stories today. What if you had a murderer, or at very least a psychopath, living next door? We're also going to talk a little bit about strange UFOs that, well, they don't look like flying saucers. They look like something else that's a bit disconcerting. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this. Welcome to the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. You know, I mentioned at the outset of tonight's program that we had a big announcement that we're going to be making. And for those of you who are listening live, if you're visiting the website, www.graylianreport.com, you've already seen this. You know, this is a multimedia sort of company. What we do, we produce podcasts, we do a daily news roundup, there are articles at the website, and of course, you know, I'm an author and I produce books and things like that. There's music, we have fine music like what Caleb features each week on the program. But in addition to all those other things, I have to highlight, now this is something of a mutual effort, but really this has been spearheaded by our very own Caleb Hanks, the artist, the creator, the man behind virtually every facet of the all-new, completely original web comic, Grey Street. It feels really good to be able to say that on the microphone for the first time, and I want to congratulate Caleb Hanks. If you go to www.graylianreport.com, you'll see there in the middle column, click here to check out Grey Street. This is a new online comic, entirely free for folks who listen to the program to enjoy. And it's going to be kind of a speculative fiction of sorts that looks at real aspects of what we do. It takes you down into the bunker, but also takes you a little beyond the bunker and looks at some of the myth and history that has surrounded this program for the last couple of years. Right off the bat, the first issue of Gray Street features our encounter with a baby Hadal. Some of you who've listened for a long time may remember what a Hadal is. You're going to be seeing constant themes on this program, ranging from the Hadals and our interactions with the Hadals to, you know, the cosmic lovers and all that stuff. Cosmic lovers are really interesting when we actually see those on screen. And then a few surprises. We're going to go into the depths of the Thuloid monstrosities, but we can't say too much right now. I just want to say to Caleb Hanks, this looks fantastic, and I hope sincerely that all the listeners out there and people who visit the website, I hope you'll all enjoy this endeavor just as much as I have enjoyed reading it. And of course, Tyler and I will have a little bit of input in terms of writing this, but really it's mostly Caleb's handiwork, and Caleb, I have to say, it looks really great. You've represented us well.
Well, thank you. I've tried to represent you in a nice comic-y fashion.
If I looked as good in real life as I do in this comic, I would just be the consummate ladies man. And Tyler's like a vampire or something.
Yeah.
Tyler, do you like the way that you look in Gray Street?
I do. I think the art is incredible.
I think it's really good. It's colorful. It's got, you know what it reminds me a little bit of? I don't know why, but there's something a little bit, it reminds me of kind of like a little, it's a little David Lynch-y, you know? There's a bit of a kind of like a Twin Peaks kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that, too. And so it's just a really, I don't know, the whole thing just looks fantastic. Caleb, you did a great job. So that's Gray Street. And folks out there in the listening audience, if you'd like to, again, it's right there. All you have to do is click the banner, and that'll take you to Gray Street. You can also visit www.graylionreport.com/GRAY Street, Gray Street, and that'll take you to it as well. And you can read that, and I understand it's going to be updated fairly regularly. Right, Pee-wee?
Yeah, I just put like a first issue out just to have the kind of lump idea of what was going to be, but I think what I'm going to do is...
Did you say lumpy?
Lumpy, lump-er-a-lump.
Lump-er-a-lump, yeah.
I'm going to update it every week, I believe, with a new page, and it's just going to be a kind of ongoing thing. But it's just kind of fun because I think everybody has a lot of attachments to these mythical creatures like Hadals, and we'll probably get into Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and stuff like that. But I think people in the blogosphere are really going to enjoy it because I'm going to start incorporating some of our buddies into this. And by the end of this issue, you will see Red Pill Junkie in some action sequences. And RPJ, I'm sure you're listening right now. And get ready, buddy. You're going to be doing some serious battling.
He's going to be slogging the evil Hadal Empire. So, you know, I have to say, I'm very anxious to see that, by the way. But I can't wait to see where this goes. And again, it just adds an entirely new dimension to what we do with the Graylion Report. You know, for the time being, we're always looking at different things. But everything that you have access to at graylionreport.com, you can access entirely for free. It is a labor of love. There's a lot of hard work that goes into it. And, you know, although we do get complaints, after last week's program, there were one or two, you know, people who had said, really, I mean, here's this citizens hearing and you guys were so silly. You know, one guy wrote me and very respectfully said I turned off the show in the middle of the episode. But, you know, of course, he missed all the good stuff because had you listened all the way through, we got into the truly serious analysis of that toward the end of the program. I would also argue, though, that there were aspects of that entire thing that were so absurd, especially when I found out that they were paying former members of Commerce, Commerce.
Might as well be,
former members of Congress. They're paying them $20,000 each. I mean, sometimes the only way that you can respond to the absurdity in real life is to treat it humorously on this program, and that offers for people who listen to this show an escape. And that's why the overwhelming response we get from people is typically very good. But you know, what we do is we put a lot of work behind it, and it's a labor of love. And we, of course, you know, always appreciate your emails, your comments, good or bad. We appreciate all the different varieties of support that you offer. And as always, also say right above the Gray Street button on our homepage there, you'll see there's a PayPal donate. And I encourage people, if you can, if you will, and if you'd like to help us, you can always send donations directly to the Graylion Report to help us continue our efforts. There'll be much more to come. This isn't the only thing. We've got a lot of projects underway, but, you know, we want to thank our own Caleb Hanks for really spearheading this new addition to your weekly lineup of the fringe that you get from this program. And with that, and speaking of contributions from fine folks out there like you, I want to get to a couple of listener emails. Victor writes, with regard to your mention of doing a show on the Federal Reserve, all I can say is yes, please. Sounds interesting, as long as you don't smother it in pure Alex Jones stupid.
Which would be, I don't know, I've been doing a lot of reading lately, and it seems whenever you discuss the Federal Reserve, you're automatically going to be kind of pigeonholed into that patriot type frame, which is actually used as a pejorative in today's media reports.
You know, I noticed that when Victor wrote, well, actually, I'll just finish his email and then we'll comment about it a bit. He says, there are some interesting ideas there, but the problem is it's often covered by people with very little understanding of economics and from a pure paleo-conservative gold standard angle. Now, I'll tell you, I've looked at, when it comes to economics, I guess maybe Victor says that because, you know, having listened to this program, there have been times in the past where I have gotten deeply into economics. I try not to focus on that too much on this program. Gosh, it almost makes me wish that there was another outlet for that. Maybe we'll just have to do a second show each week, guys, but I digress. You know, I've read End the Fed by Ron Paul. You know, I've studied, in terms of economics, you know, what we might call, the Austrian economic approach that would have been espoused by Ludwig von Mises and the like. I've also read more contemporary books that look at things from a Keynesian approach to economics, which a lot of the Fed's policies these days, I think, involves that kind of modern fiat. I mean, obviously, it has to an extent because there is the fiat-based currency that we have. We are no longer on a gold standard in the United States. And then furthermore, when we look at the emergence of all different kinds of new currency, you know, the libertarians especially have been very eagerly, well, I guess, I don't know if they've eagerly accepted it entirely, but I know that there's been a surge of interest in Bitcoin, especially since the incredible fluctuation in the prices. I think right now it's up a little over $120, but at its height it got up well over $200. And then there was a drop. One person claimed they'd lost $50,000 in their investments when the Bitcoin bomb busted a while back. So, and the latest story today I had seen was that apparently the encoding with Bitcoin can allow for such things as images and even websites and web addresses and things like that to be included. But apparently there was some pretty nasty pornographic linkage that was going on in the actual metadata within the Bitcoins, in addition to things like ASCII images, drawn using basic characters of, for instance, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke. So there's a really, really, really weird economic climate out there right now. I'll tell you that we're not going to get into the Federal Reserve too in depth right now, but having looked at it from so many different perspectives, I think he's right. There are a lot of interesting things that could be said without having to talk about the creature from Jekyll Island. You know, that's most of the time, and that's a great book, it's very interesting, but I think that a lot of people, when you talk about the Federal Reserve, that's basically all they'll talk about. You know, before that book was written, there was another book back in, I believe, 1955 that was written called Secrets of the Federal Reserve. It was the first book that ever outlined a conspiracy, okay, underlying the formation of the Federal Reserve and its institution in the United States. That was written by a very controversial political commentator, if you will. He wasn't exactly well known, and he was certainly controversial because of some of the viewpoints that he had espoused over the years, but his name was Eustace Mullins. And his story, I will tell you this much, but we'll save the longer form version of this for a later date. I met Eustace Mullins years and years ago by happenstance. It was just a chance encounter. He happened to be coming through Asheville along with a gentleman who was his kind of caretaker at the time named Jesse Lee. Mullins was restricted to a wheelchair at the time, but of course this guy had written all these interesting books, and when I found out he was the first guy that had written a book about the Federal Reserve, I wanted to go meet him, and he was at this hotel, and they held a little group conference, if you will. It was really just eight people. Christopher McCollum, a field correspondent of the program, as well as Vance Pollock and myself, we were there and a few others, and we got to meet Eustace Mullins. And I spoke with the guy, and I said, did you ever happen to know, for instance, a guy by the name of William Cooper? And Mullins told me, oh, yeah. He says, you know, the first UFO conference that Cooper apparently went to in the UK, he said, I went with him to that. And I said, I also hear that you knew J. Edgar Hoover. And he said, oh, yeah, of course. I said, Mullins, I understand that J. Edgar Hoover called you the most dangerous man in America. And here he is. He'd had a stroke. And so Mullins was, restricted to sitting in a wheelchair. But he kind of chuckled and goes, You know, that was just a term of endearment. So he was very lighthearted about things, even in his old age. He only I think he only lived maybe another month after that. But it was fascinating talking with this guy, and the story of why he wrote a book about the Federal Reserve had been this. It was 1955. He was living in Washington, D.C. I think he had a job as a, you know, like a, it was a low-level job. I don't even remember what the description was, but he worked with the Library of Congress. Well, a bunch of his friends, he wanted to be a writer, a novelist, something like that. And a bunch of his friends said, Eustace, you should come with us up to St. Elizabeth's. The mental hospital up here. There's this crazy old poet up there, and you would really find him interesting. So Eustace goes, the poet was Ezra Pound, and Ezra Pound apparently took Eustace and said to him, boy, he handed him like a dollar bill and said, I want you to find out everything you can about this. And he says, what, a dollar bill? And he says, no, look at the top, and it says Federal Reserve Note. And he says, I want you to find out everything you can for me about that. And what resulted, he utilized information that was kept in the Library of Congress and whatnot, and Eustace Mullins ended up writing this book called The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. I think the entire thing, it's out of print, and you can actually read the entire thing online now. But, again, Mullins was very controversial for some of his political views and things like that. You can read more about that online. It's just one more big piece of the ever-emerging narrative that's going on out there. And, of course, it was very interesting for me to get to meet this little old guy right before he passed away. Truly fascinating. So, yeah, maybe we will do an episode about the Federal Reserve. I think there are aspects of that story that maybe we could lend that, well, you're not going to hear a whole lot about elsewhere. Concluding our listener email section, Tony writes, Micah, a month or so ago, you had discussions on a few episodes about the phenomenon of high strangeness entering the lives of people that investigate UFOs and other paranormal phenomena. You know, Caleb and Tyler, bless their hearts. They get involved in this program, and all of a sudden they're under 24-hour surveillance.
Bummer.
Well, for whatever reason, Tony writes, I was thinking about this last night and was wondering how prevalent this is with maybe MUFON researchers. That's the Mutual UFO Network. Now, Caleb said it may be pronounced MUFON.
I've heard a lot of people say MUFON. I was out west.
I guess, you know, living in a rural part of Western North Carolina with all the cows that we are, you know, that we have out here, I must be, you know, I guess I've taken a liking to saying MUFON rather than MUFON. MUFON.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know, you know, cattle mutilations.
We need to ask somebody.
I guess if it's UFO studies, it's MUFON. If it's cattle mutilation studies, it's MUFON, right? But I digress. Yet again, many of the examples you have discussed in the past were investigative authors. I was wondering if this phenomenon exists with the rank and file MUFON investigator. From my understanding, many of these people are normal people with day jobs, or they're even retirees. It would be a rude awakening for someone like this to be receiving ghost calls, strange visitors, or to be followed by black SUVs. Thanks for your good work, and keep spreading the cosmic love, Tony. Well, to answer your question, Tony, I'm not sure that we could say that the average MUFON investigator or anything like that would necessarily experience this sort of phenomenon. There are some of them, and I'll tell you this: I've known a few MUFON researchers over the years. And it always seems to be on a case-by-case basis. If the person is a slightly more grounded, skeptically oriented researcher, someone who maybe has a background in aviation or in government themselves, and they're just interested in UFO reports, almost never will they have that happen. And then there are the ones that are really hardcore into alien brotherhood, you know, in the Galactic Federation, and they're trying to save Earth from itself and all this. Those types that I think that buy a little more into the, you know, the kookier aspects of ufology will also tell you that they're under surveillance and that they're, you know, I mean, that's not the case in every instance, but I'll know that MUFON researchers and investigators that I've met over the years typically they have to qualify to be able to be a researcher, and they know how to conduct field research. You know, most of them, they know how to get out there, and they know how to interview witnesses and things like that. It's always usually been good experiences, but I can think of at least one I met a few years ago that probably believe that there was some grand dark conspiracy going on and that he was in the middle of it, you know. And I think that's just individual interpretation. Everyone is subject to their interpretation. And, you know, you never know. You just never know. There are people all around you who hold very strange beliefs, and, of course, who hold at times what are some very, very dark secrets just as well. Which leads us to our next news story, which I want to talk about. Sometimes you think you know the world around you. Sometimes you think you know what's going on. And then you are utterly overtaken with surprise at the realization that, wow, maybe what you thought you knew wasn't exactly what was taking place. What if right next door, for instance, you found out that three women had been kept in captivity for close to a decade Can you believe that? This is the story. This is the one, the big one I saw. USA Today had carried it this morning in an amazing turn of events. This is truly amazing. There were three women who had gone missing about a decade ago and were found alive yesterday, living secretly in a residential area in Cleveland. The three young women were said to be in fairly good physical condition, of course, after having been kept in captivity for about 10 years. They've been returned to their families, but police who had arrested three middle-aged brothers in the case said today that they will move slowly before pressing the women for details on their ordeal. The stunning discovery of the three women ended a mystery that had perplexed the city for as long as a decade. Each had gone missing separately. Apparently, Miss Berry, I believe her name was Linda Berry, she had disappeared at the age of 16 on April 21st, 2003, when she called her sister to say she was getting a ride home from her job at a Burger King. Another of the women, De Jesus was her last name, went missing at age 14 on her way home from school about a year earlier. They were found just a few miles from where they had disappeared. And then, of course, we had, Deborah Knight, I believe, who's now 32, had gone missing in 2002. Oh, I'm sorry. Deborah is her grandmother. But she had said that her, Michelle Knight is her name. Deborah Knight is the grandmother. All these names. You know how it is. And that's the thing, is half the time the media is so eager to jump on this stuff that the names all get mixed up. I'm surprised they even released the names. Michelle Knight was the third individual, now 32 years old. And she had last been seen several years ago in a van with an older man at a shopping plaza. Well, it's very interesting. The three women were freed, okay, after Amanda Berry, it's not Linda, it's Amanda Berry, her screams were heard late Monday afternoon, which alerted a neighbor who helped her slip through a small opening in a door. Also freed was a six-year-old girl believed to be Berry's daughter, according to police. Authorities declined to say whether the women were restrained or if any of them had been assaulted sexually. Now, here's where this gets interesting. Of course, there's always this cultural phenomenon that surrounds this sort of stuff. The key witness, the man who had helped them, his name was Charles Ramsey. Police rushed to the scene within 2 minutes after Berry had called 911 from the home of Charles Ramsey, who was drawn to the house by Berry's screams for help. Ramsey was just as amazed by what had taken place as virtually everyone else was at the scene. We have audio. This is what Ramsey said of the circumstances, the very bizarre circumstances that unfolded late yesterday.
I see this girl going nuts, trying to get out of her house. So I go on the porch. I go on the porch, and she says, "Help me get out. I've been in here a long time." So, you know, I figured it's a domestic violence dispute. So I open the door, and we can't get in that way because how the door is, it's so much that the body can't fit through, only your hand. So we kick the bottom, and she comes out with the little girl, and she says, "Call 911." Well, she told me it didn't register until I got to call the 911. And then I'm like, I'm calling the 911 for Amanda Berry. I thought this girl was dead. You know what I mean? And she got on the phone and she said, "Yes, this is me." The girl Amanda told the police, "I ain't just the only one. It's some more girls up in that house." So they went up there, you know, 30, 40 deep. And when they came out, it was just astonishing. Right. I barbecue with this dude. We eat ribs and whatnot and listen to salsa music. You see where I'm coming from?
And you had no indication that there was anything.
Not a clue that girl was in that house or anybody else was in there against their will. Because how he is, he just comes out to his backyard, plays with the dogs, tinker with his cars and motorcycles, goes back in the house. So he's somebody that you look away because he's not doing nothing but the average stuff. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Nothing exciting about him. Well, Until today,
indeed. He had ribs with the guy and listened to salsa music in his backyard. I always thought that was an interesting statement to be made.
So it was a collaborative effort, though.
Apparently what had happened when the police arrived, they arrested Ariel Castro, 52 years of age. He was the owner of the house, but his two brothers apparently were also involved. This was Pedro Castro and O'Neill Castro. They were age 54 and 50, respectively. So they're three 50-something-year-old guys who had apparently been involved in the kidnapping of these women who had been held hostage at the location. One of them is believed to have actually given birth to a child while she was there. It's just truly, truly bizarre. But as you can hear, Charles Ramsey, the man who actually was credited with helping the women escape. Of course, the one that he had immediately helped was Amanda Berry, whose screams he had heard. He managed to get to the door, get her out of the house. They called 911. Now all three women are apparently safe and back with their families. After, if not being presumed dead, after having gone missing for at least a decade.
What's so weird to me is how does it register as logical within three individual people? I mean, obviously they're insane if they're entrapping people and keeping them in their basement, but, you know, is that something genetic? You know, like, what is going on there to make three people think, yeah, let's trap women and keep them in our basement?
That's a good question, and I think that, I mean, again, today, it's just the bizarre news episode of the Gray Alien Report, because, I mean, there's so much weirdness going on out there. But, you know, you ask a very good question there, Caleb, and Tyler, this is something that will certainly be interesting to you. You know, I've got this book I picked up a few years ago called The Murderer Next Door, Why the Mind is Designed to Kill by David M. Buss, okay? And now this book primarily looks at both an evolutionary reason why the author believes that certain people are driven to kill, as well as kind of the sociological factors, the cultural factors having to do with that. Now, in this instance, these women weren't killed, but they were imprisoned. And I find that there are some parallels, okay, between this story and what the author describes in this book, The Murderer Next Door. And it's interesting. He writes, "The key to understanding why sexual rivalries lie behind so many murderous thoughts and also so many actual murders, and we might also say similar crimes like what we witnessed today, is that in the evolutionary competition of life, the highest stakes involve whether or not we successfully find a mate. And not just any mate, but a reproductively valuable mate. And so much about who commits murders and why they do relates to this central truth." The author goes on to say, we also have to look at the striking facts about murder, such as the fact that more men commit these kinds of violent crimes than women. It's roughly 87% of all murders that are committed by men. We can consider that statistic and simply conclude that men are just a good deal more violent than women, but then again, that doesn't explain why they actually are. So in the book, the man tries to go into what actually is underlying this, and the essential idea is that sexual rivalry, okay, and the competition, it basically how humans evolved to be able to pair, okay, find a mate and to reproduce sexually, that this actually is underlying so much of the, because look at this, there are elements of control. Obviously, this is absolutely second. No person in their right mind would act this way, but these three men working together had not killed these women. They had just kept them captive and did God knows what to them. You know, we can only imagine. And it's incredible because this was taking place in a widely populated area. Again, you know, the neighbor Charles Ramsey said, you know, I'd gone over there and had wing or had ribs with a guy and we'd listen to salsa music. You'd never have thought that these individuals were involved in this sort of thing. And it's just, it's absolutely very incredible. It's really, truly incredible to me to look at all this. And in this book, it's so funny because The Murderer Next Door, this interesting point is made. It says the evolution of sexual reproduction, which made its first appearance on Earth 1.2 billion years ago, radically complicated life and introduced a great deal of strife into it. We think of survival of the fittest, competition in terms of the struggle against nature's threats, and we assume that some of us are better equipped to contend with those threats than others. Sexual reproduction added a whole new element of competition, that of members of the same sex vying to hook up with the most appealing potential mates. That intense competition opened the door also for such things as murder. And I think that we could probably make the case that, I mean, look at it. There are three men, three brothers, okay, who were working together to conceal the fact that they had kidnapped women, okay. We can't, again, authorities haven't, I think, said that there was or was not sexual misconduct. Obviously, I mean, one of the women was believed to have had a child while she was in captivity, so it seems pretty obvious that there was, again, you know, sexual mistreatment going on there. So there is this sexual component to this underlying everything. And again, I think that if we look at things in evolutionary biological terms, what is it about culture? What is it about, you know, striving to find a mate, or do these things influence an individual who would go to greater lengths than the average Joe to secure, okay, a woman or several women and literally hold them hostage illegally, knowing that you're breaking the law for 10 years and keep them locked up in a house in an area where they are bound to eventually escape or be able to draw the attention of and concern of authorities. I mean, it's a truly bizarre story. Truly, truly bizarre. And I'm not certain that I know exactly what to make of that. Thank God nothing worse happened to the women. But, you know, what's even funnier, though, is that I saw this story. I think I found it on my Google News Roundup when I was doing the news this morning for the site. But some of the popular websites, the news sites, Drudge Report and the like, I didn't see this story on those sites. And I wonder why that is. Maybe we could hope that certain news sources were actually waiting until the actual facts came out before they jumped on it and misreported everything like so often seems to be the case these days. But I find it very, very strange. It's truly bizarre. And there was a similar story to that, I believe, was Germany, I think, a few years ago, where there was a man who had, you know, held a woman captive in like a, literally what they said was likened to being a dungeon below his house. But the woman, I think, in that instance was actually his biological daughter. So what is it that causes, you know, again, in the most rare instances, you know, and typically men to go to such extremes for purposes of control? And, you know, is it natural selection? Is it something biological inherited, something that we've evolved to do? Is it really the only way that some men feel that they can express their dominance over a situation of sexual pairing? It's truly, truly bizarre. And of course, I think that it goes without question to say that that kind of thing is indeed very, very unsettling. What are your thoughts about that? You can contact us, info@graylingreport.com. And, of course, there are other ways that you can reach us here on the program, which we have detailed there on the website. For the time being, it's about time to go out to break. When we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit more about the weird news of the day. And I also want to get into a story we didn't touch on last week. Now, the story itself has been explained, but I'll just tell you this. We did a little bit of research, and you wouldn't believe the ufological component to one of the popular stories of the week and how this has been an ongoing phenomenon. We'll look at that after this. I'm Micah Hanks. Back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, talking about this disturbing story, truly, truly disturbing story. I still don't know what precisely to make of this, but again, it just goes to show sometimes you don't know what may be going on right under your nose, or at very least right next door. I mean, what would you do if you found out that there, you know, that there had been three men basically holding three women hostage for 10 years at your next door neighbor's house?
You know what? I was reading this right before the show. The creepiest thing that I heard was a couple of years prior, they had seen a naked woman crawling around in the backyard of the house.
Really?
Yeah. And it's like,
I hadn't seen this report.
That's like something out of that movie Disturbia or something. You know, it's just something creepy.
Okay. So someone obviously says that they've seen this. Did they report that to the police?
I don't even know.
Well, you know, gosh, anyway, and then I think someone else, I don't remember which of the sites had carried this, but I'd noticed that the story had read that the police had responded within 2 minutes to the 911 call, but that, of course, the first woman who was released, Amanda Berry, was really the one who had saved the day. I mean, she literally, when Charles Ramsey apparently had made the 911 call, she grabbed the phone and identified herself and said, "Yes, I'm here, and there are others, there are more women up there in that house." Gosh, and you know, the way that Ramsey in that audio soundbite describes that there are more women up there, you know, it almost evokes like a Norman Bates kind of thing. I mean, what drives an individual, let alone three individuals, to behave in that way? I mean, is there really something about the, what did they feel like they were, sexually impotent or something? I mean, was there something going on that these guys didn't feel? Quite the contrary, they felt that they had to take such a, what is it, the level of control, I guess. I mean, literally, I'm struggling for words to try and even put this out there. Did they feel that they had to exert so much control over the situation?
Well, it makes me wonder if they weren't, since all three brothers were involved in this thing, if it wasn't because of some sort of traumatic parenting that went on, like if their parents abused them into this skewed perception of of thinking.
Did their parents hold them hostage when they were kids? You know, I don't know. Oh, gosh, it's just incredible, you know. And what worries me is that you see also there's this, you know, I think we said before we took the airwaves tonight that we live in something of a police state. But by the same token, we live in what you might also call a media state. And there are so many problems, not only with the way that, you know, law enforcement, I have personal qualms. I don't want to attack everyone who's a police officer. I've had friends who are, you know, members of the police department here in Asheville, you know. But I do get a little discouraged. For instance, the other night I'd actually, you know, had an incident. I've talked with the guys here in the studio about this. It was a rainy night and I was rear-ended and the individuals tried to get away. And I managed to get their license plate number, and Caleb actually even saw this happen. But when I reported the incident, because I had gone down the road, I'd pulled into a gas station where it was sheltered, and I had, you know, tried to assess the damage. Basically, I was reprimanded when I contacted the highway patrol, and they said, "Well, why didn't you stay at the scene?" And I said, "Let me actually point this out. If I hadn't left the scene, I wouldn't have been able to get the information to prove who had actually, you know, rear-ended me." And so the thing is what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to sit there and know that nothing is going to be done, you know? And then imagine my satisfaction when I actually do report to the authorities and they reprimand me and say, "You shouldn't have left the scene," even if that was going to help you prove this. And they said, "Well, we'll file a report or whatever and we'll call you back." Of course, they never called back. You know, so even when you attempt to get enough information to be able to arm yourself with knowledge so that justice can be served, then the police still do nothing. You know, so I don't know. But the point I'm making here is, what is the point I'm making? No, the point I'm making here is that many would argue that we're in this kind of a police state. And it does seem often to me that when you need help, you're not getting it. Now, my question is, if there was a woman crawling around in the backyard of this house, you know, why the hell did that go? Or did someone not report that? Was that unreported?
They might have just thought it was some sort of strange, I don't know, something that they were into.
They were shooting pornography or something.
God knows.
You know, this seems really strange because there are no indications so far from eyewitness reports. People being inside the house said it looked like a normal environment. There are now reports of people claiming they've called police previously, but authorities in Cleveland are saying there are no records of that. So we're actually seeing the story change as time goes on.
Well, you know, that tends to be what happens, which, again, you know, I'll say that, yes, I mean, that's one of the problems with the way that media handles these kinds of stories. When you have a really, really weird, bizarre story like this come out, you know, the media jumps all over it, and they're literally fighting with each other to try and get the information out before the competitors get the information out. And what has time and time again, CNN, of course, was reprimanded for doing this, you know, during the days following the Boston Marathon bombing, when the information had been released about a suspect that ended up, of course, you know, not having anything to do with the bombing. And of course, this man, even though he was proved to be innocent and that it had been a mistake on part of CNN releasing the name, his reputation is potentially tarnished. He's always going to be associated with having, quote unquote, been a suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing. So, you know, you have to be more careful about these kinds of things. And so, you know, that is one problem in addition to you know, what I'd mentioned about the quote-unquote police response to these sorts of things. And so I see that what ends up happening is that there's this kind of duality. You know, it's the way that information is put out. And then there's the actual, well, I don't know what you would want to call it. But I think that, you know, it's a very, very, very confusing situation right now. And more people, especially what you might call liberty advocates, they're concerned about people's, you know, about people's rights and their privileges and what they're going to be able to you know, to maintain in terms of their freedoms. Every time we see a violent crime or anything like this, okay, and of course the media doesn't just cover it, they blow it out of proportion. Then we see there's sort of a legislative reaction to it when it has to do with guns. You know, for instance, I heard a story, you know, with regard to the absurdity going on in the media and, of course, in Washington with regard to guns. Two little boys that were in a school had taken pencils and were pretending to shoot at each other with pencils. They got kicked out of school. They were, like, suspended. Okay. I'm just wondering, my God, when you have a story as bizarre as this, what's going to happen? The media is going to take this. They're going to turn it in every different direction. And then what's going to be legislated to prevent people from holding captives in their house for 10 years? You know, I mean, I know that sounds absurd, but just wait. You know, something really bizarre will come about. And it just seems that the general response is media jumps all over something first. And then, of course, government gets involved and says, well, we've got to get this off the streets, whether it be guns, whether it be bombs, whether it be anything else. The front page story on Time Magazine, I'll use that as a segue because I wanted to talk about this as well. this week, it says, homeland insecurity. Do we need to sacrifice privacy to be safer? That's a very good question. It's remained a contentious issue. But I'll tell you this, and this comes back around also to something that one of our listeners had written in about. I believe it was Tony who had asked if MUFON investigators had experienced strange things like a lot of authors claim to. I'll just tell you this. I personally, in the past, have experienced a bit of telephonic weirdness. I have. I remember, you know, Chris Hayes had also discussed having this happen where he felt like there was someone. I mean, he'd clearly heard voices and things like that, and it was pretty clear that he thought his cell phone communications were being monitored. I've known a lot of people who've had that, and I've had plenty of weird things happen myself. Well, The Guardian carried this story earlier this week, and it had said that the real capabilities and behavior of the U.S. surveillance state are almost entirely unknown to the American public because, like most things of significance done by the U.S. government, it operates behind an impenetrable wall of secrecy. But a seemingly spontaneous admission this week by a former FBI counterterrorism agent provides a rather startling acknowledgement of just how vast and invasive these surveillance activities are. Now, over the past couple of days, cable news tabloid shows such as CNN's Out Front with Aaron Burnett have been excitingly focused on the possible involvement of the Boston Marathon attack of Catherine Russell, the 24-year-old American widow of the deceased suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Now, as part of their relentless stream of leaks uncritically disseminated by the adversarial press corps, anonymous government officials are claiming that they are now focused on telephone calls between Russell and Tsarnaev that took place before and after the attack to determine if she had prior knowledge of the plot or had participated in any way. But this led to a very interesting revelation, which I think highlights not only my frustrations with a lot of this, but also, I think, concerns that just about anyone should have. Because, in all likelihood, you're being listened to right this moment. Now, Wednesday night, Burnett interviewed Tim Clemente, okay, I believe he was a former FBI counterterrorism agent, about whether the FBI would be able to discover the contents of past telephone conversations between these two aforementioned parties. He quite clearly insisted that they could, and he said, get this, there is a way. Well, first, actually, let me back up, and I'll tell you what Burnett said. Burnett asks him, Tim, is there any way, obviously, there is a voicemail that they can try and get the phone companies to give up at this point? It's not a voicemail, it's just a conversation, but there's no way they can actually find out what happened right unless she tells them. And he says, no, there is a way. We certainly have ways in national security investigations to find out exactly what was said in that conversation. It's not necessarily something that the FBI is going to want to present in court, but it may help lead the investigation and or lead to questioning of her. We certainly can find that out. So they actually can get that, Burnett says. People are saying, look, that is incredible. And he says, well, welcome to America. All that stuff is being captured as we speak, whether we know it or we like it or not. Listen, let me read that to you one more time. Welcome to America. Putz. All that stuff is, he literally says, no, welcome to America. All that stuff is being captured as we speak, whether we know it or we like it or not. I mean, that is just incredible to me. So, you know, and again, I don't want to present all these stories as though I'm trying to tie together a narrative. I like to segue, but, you know, these are all stories unto themselves. And we're wrapping up this hour with this one before we get to some talk about UFO missiles during the second hour of tonight's program. But I'll just tell you this. If you've ever gotten that weird feeling that maybe somebody's spying on you, well, maybe they actually were. And in truth, you very well may, in fact, almost certainly, are subject to what I would say, I think a lot of Americans would probably call unlawful spying, okay, that is being carried out by government agencies for purposes of national security. In other words, even if you are not a suspected or a person of interest, you know, suspected terrorist, anything like that, by virtue of being an American, welcome to America. Apparently, this is what it means to be an American. You're going to be subjected to surveillance by governing bodies. That, to me, is pretty disturbing.
I certainly hope in our line of business people are listening to us.
I think people are. You know, I have nothing to hide, and I know certainly we would hope for other reasons that people are listening to us. But, Caleb, there are probably also, well, those people listening to you. Big Brother, he's watching you, and you're watching us. We're the Graylians. We'll be back right after this.
The weird, the unusual, the outback. Andrew Nicholson's latest, Weird Australia. Real reports, uncanny creatures, strange sightings, extraordinary encounters. Weird Australia, the latest from researcher Andrew Nicholson. For more information, visit WeirdAustralia.com.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And that's Dick Oakley, our very own Andy Richter. No, I think that would be Caleb. If anything, Caleb's the guy over there who's actually voicing the show now.
I like to pretend that I am.
That's right, absolutely. A quick shout out to Reptile, Justin. Our good friend Milton, and another Milton who's being discussed in the chat room this evening, none other than Milton William Cooper. You know, I think you start talking about the appearance of a surveillance state, as the last story during the last hour suggested, and I think that you do begin to evoke those kinds of themes, the conspiracies and things like that. I almost feel bad sometimes. Because on this program, you know, I like to focus on the weird stuff. Obviously, it's pretty UFO-centric, but this isn't just a UFO show. You know, we like to deal with, you know, weird things that are going on in the world and the news, you know, political conspiracy from time to time. And this has been a recurring subject that we've been talking about on the program a lot as of late. But in addition to those kinds of things, you know, I do like to talk about UFOs from time to time, cryptozoology, and all this sort of stuff just as well. And yet, it seems that the way that things are going out there in the world, there is a greater precedent, I guess, a need almost for discussing the conspiratorial aspects of all this. Because we're constantly being bombarded with it. We see that the media treats news that comes about one way. Actually several ways, because it seems that every news agency, in an effort, in a rush to try and get their information out there before anyone else, there's often, I think, different narratives that emerge, and these different narratives tend to kind of, I guess they kind of contribute to an ongoing distrust that Americans, and not just Americans, I mean people all around the world, have, not only for their government, not only for what they see on television. Half the time you don't even know if you can trust the people in your neighborhood, as we found out with this story earlier today about the Cleveland, the three women who had been kept hidden for three women who had been kept hidden for nearly a decade. Now, again, I'm not trying to tie all that together. The news, their stories, we feature each story unto itself. But, you know, it's just, I think that the overwhelming, if there is anything that can kind of across the board be said about all this, is that, you know, the world is changing. People's attitudes are changing. The way that we interpret what we are told, and really, frankly, I think the way we are being told news, it's changing. Everything is changing. The world is changing. On this program, I often advocate something that we call cosmic love. And I think the reason that we talk about that is, you know, the enlightened state that you can maintain by being educated, by keeping yourself grounded, by educating others, but being discriminating about what you choose to incorporate into your belief system. You know, I think it's okay to listen to Alex Jones. I listen to Alex Jones. I enjoy the guy, but I don't take everything that the guy says 100% seriously. I don't take everything that I read in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. I mean, again, those are supposed to be accredited news sources, but at what point was fair and balanced taken to mean, well, we put our political slant on this and we filter everything through an ideological window? half the time you don't know what the hell that you can trust and what you can believe. You know, you have to be so careful. And so often people go ahead and they just take whatever is told to them, whatever is shoved down their throat more appropriately, they take it for granted and they accept it as truth. In other words, I think people are more comfortable with being told what to believe than actually coming to a decision or coming to a determination of their own based on facts, based on reading. And more often than not, the official narrative will differ from what the facts tend to dictate. I think that that's so often the case. I mean, whether it be, you know, what we talked about earlier, the Federal Reserve, you know, or again, surveillance, a surveillance state. You know, media's changed. Yes, and of course, it seems that every time the media reports a massacre of some sort, the response in terms of the law, the response in terms of, you know, the beefing up of security and literally what we might call the trend toward or the movement toward a police state, yes, it increases more and more each day. People are watching you more and more. And, of course, the discussion seems to be that, well, we want to have people with less and less at their disposal, whether that has to do with Second Amendment rights or whether that has to do with literal invasions of your privacy in terms of what you are, or rather what privacy you think that you have, you know, what sacred aspects of your daily existence. You know, sometimes a phone call with grandma is something that you want to be able to share just with grandma, not with, you know, Big Brother sitting back up there in Washington someplace. But this story that I read here seems to indicate that, you know, even those fundamental privacies, a phone call with your kid, apparently all that is kept, all that is stored. And, you know, like you were saying during the break, Tyler, I wonder sometimes, and again, I want to say, when I mean everything, when I say everything that you say is probably being recorded, being analyzed, being monitored, you know, a couple of years ago, if you'd said that, people would say, oh, you're crazy. Come on, the government, they're not listening to everything that everyone says. Listen to this statement. Okay, again, that this fellow, this gentleman, Tim Clemente, maybe Clement, but he's got the extra E on the end there. I'm assuming that there's an emphasis on that. He'd said, listen, welcome to America. All of that stuff is being captured. By all of that stuff, we mean every telephone conversation Americans have with one another on U.S. soil. And that's obtained without a search warrant. And he says, of course, it's all being captured as we speak. And Tyler, like you were saying during the break, you know, that's not the only information that's being fielded. Think about this IRS story that came out. And furthermore, where the IRS had said earlier that certain individuals, if there is a need to, or if there is what they consider a legitimate concern over whether they are accurately reporting their earnings, the IRS may go read their emails just as well. But they're not asking for those emails. They're not going to you first and saying, do you mind if we take a look at your emails and just make sure everything matches up? No. They already have access. And whatever the case may be, whoever or whatever agency is obtaining that information, apparently the IRS has access to if they feel that it is necessary. And their excuse for going and reading people's private correspondences is, well, we don't think that Americans have a realistic expectation that their private communications will not be subject to basically being peered at, picked at, pored over, and reviewed by agencies.
Well, talking about the just kind of invasive surveillance, I mean, they pretty much bluntly reported on the news that when the suspects from the Boston bombings started, or when they were starting to look into that, or into them, they were saying, you know, sources had reported that there was no sort of malevolent intent and monitored conversations they have. It's like, what does that mean? Does that mean that we're bluntly saying, yeah, we listen in on your conversations, whoever you are, if you're suspected of anything?
That's exactly what
they're telling us.
You don't even have to be suspected of anything. You're just listened. You know, it's funny. I'll tell you, this is kind of a funny story. When it comes to weird stuff that happens on telephones, I can tie this in with Mothman, okay? And I'm going to. I'm gonna. Don't tell me you're not gonna do it. I'm gonna do it. You know, years and years ago, researcher Joshua P. Warren and I, we remain friends to this day. And Joshua and I went through a period where we would, every time we would get on the phone, we would start talking about Mothman. I don't know why. Every time we'd get on the phone. And
did the Mothman ever contact you? Did he ask you?
Hello, John Klein.
What am I holding in my hand?
Chapstick.
What am I wearing? Chaps.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but anyway, yeah, so every time we'd get on the telephone, It just seemed that the conversation would come back around. You know, Josh and I have always been fascinated with John Keel and all that sort of stuff. And so we would talk a lot about Mothman. And it seemed that at least on two, possibly three occasions within about a week and a half period, we had these weird things happen where we would inexplicably get disconnected. I mean, it was happening enough to the point that I remember on one occasion, we both called each other from landlines because we thought that our cell phone service was just, you know, not being effective. Apparently, you know, Josh lived out in the country, and I just wondered if there was something going on. So the weirdest incident, I remember we were both on landlines. He was at his house, and I was at an office. And we were sitting there, and we were chin-wagging and talking about, and of course, we get around to the discussion of Mothman. And sure enough, we get disconnected. I'm like, man, there it goes again. No explanation for why we'd become disconnected. So I hit read on everything, and I hear the on the other side there, Josh is pushing buttons. He thought we'd been disconnected and is trying to call me back, but we'd managed to reconnect by you know hitting read all there. But when we did it, I could hear in the background the little beep 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 beep. And I said, Josh, are you there? And he goes, yeah. Shh, listen. And we both could hear what sounded like, you know, again, like what we could only interpret as being a third line that had been hooked up to the telephone system and that, you know, had become disconnected when Josh and I became disconnected. He and I managed to reconnect the call, but we could hear very faintly in the background this little beep, 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 beep. And we both went around. I went around to make sure that there weren't any phones off the hook in the building where I was. Josh did the same thing, couldn't find anything. And he says, listen to that, man. It sounds like somebody had been listening to our conversation. And I'm thinking, why, first of all, would anyone be interested in hearing about Mothman? And it reminds me of something that Nick Redfern wrote about a few years ago. He wrote a book called, I believe, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, and he had pointed out in that book that you know, the Air Force and other agencies had taken legitimate interest in people who were UFO researchers, but not for the reasons that you would think they had many years ago. It really had a lot more to do, apparently, with people saying that they, and this is interesting, When they would use or rather it was believed, I guess, by government that when people said that they were serious ufologists and they were interested in exotic looking aircraft, government agencies were concerned at the time, maybe a few decades ago, and perhaps even still today to an extent, that researchers who did this might be employing their interest in UFOs or maybe more importantly extraterrestrial UFOs as a cover for their attempts at trying to actually gain access to information, you know, about secret aviation projects and things that the Air Force had been undertaking and this sort of thing. And so I wondered if in any way, shape, or form that could be the case in a modern sense with when people call each other up and they're talking about something and they use a weird term like Mothman. I wondered, well, is, you know, in this post 9/11 world in which we live, do people think that, you know, quote unquote homegrown terrorists are going to use a term like Mothman or something like that as a, what would you call it, you know, a decoy or use that as a term, you know, a hot term, a code word or something along those lines, you know?
Yeah, for light-seeking insect in the dark.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Mothman means, you know, some secret club or some secret organization, and it's, you know, domestic terrorists, you know, which obviously...
Or drugs.
Yeah, you know, any number of things. And I'm thinking, you know, it's funny that, you know, these, what I would consider to be, I mean, it was just Josh and I just kind of BSing back and forth there, otherwise fairly mundane conversations, and yet there was enough telephonic weirdness going on that we had gotten the impression that somebody might have taken interest in listening to Josh and I talk about Mothman. You know, it's absurd that, you know, people can't just have conversations without the fear of being listened to. And so many of my friends, my God, you know, they'll come in, they'll sit down, they'll, you know, we'll meet at a restaurant or something. And, you know, if we start talking about UFOs, half the time I can't tell if they're tongue in cheek or not. They take the battery out of their phone, you know, and they say, no, I don't want people listening in on this kind of thing. And, you know, we've in the past, we've laughed at that, but it very well may be the case that, you know, in all likelihood, you are being listened to. And it happens probably a lot more frequently than most people, I think, are even comfortable admitting. But, you know, again, this is what I always say. I don't have anything to hide. I mean, I'm interested in weird stuff. Frankly, I think I'm interested in a lot of weird stuff that government apparently isn't as interested in. If you want to know more about that, read the book UFOs by Colonel John B. Alexander. Whether you love him or hate him, I think he makes a lot of very interesting points in that book about the true nature of UFO and ufological interest by government agencies. And what he says in the book is pretty clear. He says they don't have a lot of interest. You know? After the Condon Committee, well, there was no scientific merit to the study of UFOs. Or is that really the case? And they're just telling us they're not interested, and they're listening in all the while. We'll be back right after this. It is the Graylian Report. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Thank you for making this your weekly hub for the weird and the unusual. As we broadcast from that dark disquiet, the dark little corner of the web known as the Graylian Report, I'm your host, Micah Hanks, joined in studio tonight by Caleb Hanks and Tyler Pittman. Seeing all the fine folks out there in the chat room, and of course all of you who download the program on a weekly basis, our loyal listenership. We're so glad that you make this a part of your week, and we ask you to continue to do so. And, of course, you can always share your ideas, you know, comments, questions, queries, or even, you know, ideas for subjects you'd like to hear addressed on the program, as well as news stories and things. info@graylianreport.com will put you directly in touch with us about that. Now, there was a story that actually broke, I believe, literally while we were on the air last week. We're going to talk about it. We're also going to talk about a bit of investigative journalism that is pretty conclusively, I think, determined what the actual cause underlying this may have been. And then we're going to take you a little deeper. That's what we do. We broadcast from a bunker underground, and so we like to look at things that are going on in the world around us. And if we can, you know, I think it's at best often tenuous information in terms of what people will take out there, and they'll try and say, but if this happened, then there's this grand conspiracy. What if? A lot of the time, I think the connections that people try and make, especially when we have tragedies and things like that emerge in the news, a lot of the connections are tenuous. And if anything, I don't consider myself a debunker, but, you know, lately on the program, we'll take a look at a lot of those kinds of things, and we've ended up having to say, you know, maybe there isn't quite so much. Like, you know, Alex Jones, for instance, saying false flag hours after the Boston Marathon bombing. Maybe a little too soon for him to have come out and said something like that. Something else, though, that occasionally happens is quite the opposite, and that is that you look a little deeper and you actually find a new level of interest and intrigue that maybe the mainstream media wasn't touching on, and maybe other people weren't talking about when they looked into this. And that seems to be the case with a rather interesting story, which at the outset sounded, again, very unique, and then, you know, I think people looked at it and said there was probably nothing really going on. And that had to do with a passenger plane, okay, that had been described as being only seconds away from a collision with a UFO near Glasgow, according to an official investigation that was ongoing as of during showtime on this very program last week. Now, the initial story had been that a passenger jet, okay, that was flying over Glasgow, Scotland, had been less than 10 seconds from smashing into what they called a mystery object that was 3,500 feet above the outskirts of the city in which they were attempting to land. And despite an extensive investigation at the time, okay, the UK Air Prox Board, which probes reports of near misses, was unable to explain what they described as an unidentified threat, which did not appear on their radar. The scare happened as the Airbus 320 had come to land at Glasgow in sunny weather, when both pilots saw an object loom ahead at a range of 100 meters. They described it as blue and yellow, possibly silver, and it whizzed under the plane without giving the crew any time to actually react to what they were seeing. Now, the shocked pilot radioed Glasgow Airport Control Tower, "We just had something pass underneath us quite close. Have you got anything on in our area?" The tower replied, "Negative. We've got nothing on radar, and we're not talking to any traffic either." Now, both pilots gave the same description of the object, which was described as being blue and yellow, but also supposed to have been bigger than a balloon. They weren't sure exactly what this thing was. Now, it's funny, people in the chat room are saying, cue the Jaws music. Because I'll tell you this. Yes, our good friends at Open Minds magazine, they reported shortly afterward that this object could have been a flying shark. Is that the case?
One of those old humdrum theories.
Now, how's that happen? Well, apparently, now, Caleb, actually, you have the story there. What exactly was the explanation put forth with regard to a flying shark?
Supposedly what it was, it was a helium-filled remote control shark that a kid was flying around and it had, like, gotten out of range, I believe, of the remote control area and just went flying off into the air. So, obviously, Jaws is flying after this plane. But the father of the child had said that this had happened right around the same time that he saw reported on the news that this plane had encountered this bizarre spherical missile, quote-unquote, looking projectile.
And if indeed that's what happened, you know, that sounds like probably in this instance the most likely explanation. That was, and I'd first seen that story carried by Open Minds, our friends Jason, Maureen, and of course the other fine folks out there. They're literally like family to us.
They are.
I love them. But anyway, all that to say, it was a good explanation. Now, prior to that actual explanation being released, like anyone else, you know, I'm the kind of person, I don't try and append an extraterrestrial theory behind all reports of what are classified semantically, okay, categorically as unidentified flying objects. Every now and then I get emails from listenership saying, you know, gosh, Mikey, you're always harping on that. We're going to completely and forever, unforgivably unsubscribe from the Graylian Report because all you ever harp about is the distinctions between all these different things. I'm sorry. Look, here's the important thing. If we don't take seriously the distinctions that must be made between what are actual exotic aircraft, what are categorically defined as UFOs, the potential experiences that some have had with what may be, anomalous, actual physical anomalous occurrences. And then, of course, you know, such things as jet aircraft and of course, misidentified aircraft that are more conventional, but under strange circumstances can have a UFO-like appearance. Atmospheric conditions and the like. If we don't draw the distinctions between all these things, then forever and ever, amen, will all UFO reports be taken by mainstream sources, by officialdom and the like, and they will always be looked at through this very convenient extraterrestrial filter that everyone puts them through these days. You know, I've been working on a new writing project recently, and in it I kind of go after Philip J. Klass, who many times would take information, and I'll give you the best example probably of this was where in the book UFOs Explained back in 1974, Philip J. Klass goes out there and he says, we're going to explain all these UFO cases, and one of them he chose to do in the seventh chapter of the book was he took the Brown Mountain Lights, which is a variety of phenomenon that occurs right here in western North Carolina, literally about an hour away from the bunker. And Philip J. Klass said, you know, obviously we can, and the chapter was called the Brown Mountain UFOs. That's the first problem. In all likelihood, now here's what we do know about the Brown Mountain Lights. We can't trace the actual reports of the Brown Mountain Lights in modern publications back any further than 1913, which have to do with descriptions of encounters that happened around 1910 or 1911. But the thing is that USGS, there was actually a George Mansfield had been sent down by the USGS to actually go and investigate the Brown Mountain Lights back in 1922, and there'd been a previous investigation a few years before that. According to the 1922 information, the best determination they could make about what was going on in the Linville Gorge, actually I shouldn't say in the Linville Gorge because they were specifically looking at Brown Mountain, the best they could determine was that the oncoming lights of locomotives in the distance were contributing to the appearance of what some interpreted as being lights hovering over Brown Mountain, when in fact, actually, what they were seeing were locomotive lights and things like that off in the distance. The reason that they would come to a conclusion like that in 1922 was pretty obvious. George Mansfield, who had been the USGS researcher who had gone to the region and who had tried to study the lights and come up with a determination, well, first of all, in 1922, is he going to look at things and say, okay, these are obviously UFOs? That hadn't become a popular idea in our culture at that time. Furthermore, there weren't even a lot of airplanes flying at the time. I think that it had been less than two decades prior to the authoring of that report that the Wright brothers had made their historic flight at Kitty Hawk right here in the same state. And even at that time, the most advanced aircraft, were still in their infancy. And an area like the Black Mountain Range and the Linville Gorge where those illuminations are alleged to occur, it's pretty rugged territory, and there sure as heck weren't going to be test flights of experimental aircraft at that time, which of course were, you know, the precursors to what would become biplanes and things like that that were innovated and then actually utilized for aerial combat during this first World War. You weren't going to see a lot of that in the Linville Gorge at the time. The point I'm making here is that if people weren't going to be looking up to look at planes in that region, then the scientists who were trying to account for the appearance of lights around Brown Mountain at the time weren't going to be looking up either. They weren't going to look at an aerial variety of phenomenon as an explanation. And that's evidenced by the fact that in the report Mansfield put together, every instance, every observation point, they used three. There was one at a location called Cold Springs. There was another one that was at a place called Lovin's Hotel. Actually, the Lovin's Hotel location was Cold Springs. They went to a location called Blowing Rock, and then they went to a location called Ginger Cake Mountain, which is just above where people in modern times go off of Highway 181 to look for the Brown Mountain lights. But each of those locations, in terms of elevation, was about 1,000 feet higher than Brown Mountain. And thus, in every instance, they're going to be looking down at the mountain, and they're going to be able to see more of the landscape in the background as a backdrop. And so, of course, it was easy for them to say, yeah, that was a light originating from the ground for those two reasons. They weren't looking up. Okay, and then the other thing is, too, that they naturally are going to have a vantage that gives them access to lights emanating from the ground, which completely skirts the rest of the reports of strange aerial illuminations seen in the Linville Gorge. And furthermore, Brown Mountain is a good ways away from the actual Linville Gorge area, you know, that features Table Rock, Honksbill, and a lot of the other popular locations where people have seen actual lights flare up, rise into the sky, and fly through the air. Now, by definition, those are UFOs. They are unidentified flying objects. But by the 1960s, when people started saying, oh, look, the UFOs at Brown Mountain, that extraterrestrial meme had already become so popular in our culture that
there's tons of pictures of illuminations that are hovering extremely high over the mountain. And I mean, if you're standing from the overlook, the most popular overlook that you can see Brown Mountain from, there's not really much behind it that could be like on a mountain range or something like that, that could be, you know, stationary on the ground on top of a mountain shining, you know,
right.
It would have to be something that's actually floating.
Well, I would say this, and you know, while there may not be tons of, there are at least, you know, a handful of pretty good images that, again, maybe only in the last couple of decades have come forth. Charles Braswell's a photographer who in 2001, he lives, I think, down near Charlotte, and he photographed, I mean, what is clearly like a little ball of fire streaking over the region. But the first problem is that although these lights were called the Brown Mountain lights, they weren't necessarily... they weren't necessarily only seen at Brown Mountain. And I want to tie this in with Philip J. Class and then come back to what we were talking about with the misidentification of craft, because how Class comes into this is that he borrowed that popular meme of UFO that was appended to the lights at the time. And rather than looking for an actual natural phenomenon, Class went about debunking the Brown Mountain lights based on essentially the philosophical viewpoint that he had adopted, that everyone else seemed to be adopting at the time just as well, that we were indeed dealing with UFOs. And therefore, if they were UFOs, Class was going to debunk them. And he did. Categorically, though, the Brown Mountain lights, of course, are unidentified flying somethings. Maybe unidentified aerial phenomenon would be a better term to use rather than UFO. But again, I think that there's this ideological thing that is appended to the use of the term. You say UFO, people are going to think aliens and ET. And in terms of debunking that ideology, Class also thought that he had grounds to debunk the Brown Mountain lights when decades after the publication of UFOs Explained, we have some pretty good evidence that there's something else going on in the Linville Gorge. Now, I want to bring that back to the discussion of the shark flying by this aircraft over Glasgow. Probably people are saying, what are you talking about? Why would you think that? Or where would there be any kind of a connection between the two? Well, because I think that when we hear about reports of strange things flying near aircraft, we don't necessarily have to be talking about extraterrestrials. And furthermore, the skeptical researchers out there, you know, which at times I'm very much one of, we don't have to always be dismissive toward people and a culture that has become associated with UFOs. A UFO could be a number of different things. And the reason we harp on that so often on this program is illustrated by the way that Class treated the Brown Mountain lights. We harp on that on this program to draw those necessary distinctions. And not every time that someone says, I've seen a UFO, should that be, you know, cause for calling that person a wacko and say, oh, you believe in aliens. That means you saw preferably what was described as a light, but not always an illumination. Sometimes they're just aircraft, but mostly things that are seen in the sky that you can't account for. That happens quite often, and we don't always know what they are. And sometimes we never come to a complete determination about what was seen. Now, in the instance with the aircrafts over Scotland, this was believed to have been, again, I guess primarily what you would call just a toy that a child was operating. Now, I have friends, of course, who are interested in aviation. I have friends, you know, who are involved in everything from UFO research to the history of aviation. And a lot of us kind of correspond back and forth. Not all of them, you know, like to be named. And so, unfortunately, I can't give out every detail about every buddy of mine who's interested in UFOs. Some of them just don't like to, you know, if they wanted to, the whole world to know who they were, you know, they'd pass along you know, the information on blogs, or they'd have their own podcasts that they do. But it puts me in a unique position because as the guy who does blogging and writing and of course, who has a podcast, you know, I get a lot of good information from different researchers. And so a few of us have been going back and forth. And prior to the story that Open Minds carried, we had been interested in seeing if there were other stories, because in the initial report, one of the pilots had said that the object that streaked beneath the plane looked kind of like a missile, right? I was interested in seeing if there were other reports that talked about this same sort of thing. And you can obtain a lot of data. Okay, it's available to anyone on the web with regard to strange things that captains report seeing from time to time in flight. Now, I've got a bunch of those kinds of reports right here. These are all available in the public domain based on air traffic control records and flight information. You know, and this is all typically stuff that's actually reported directly by pilots, or that's corroborated with reports from ATC, air traffic control, and the like. You know, without getting into all the nitty-gritty, because there's a lot of technical jargon that is included in these reports, let me just read a couple of these reports to you. I'm going to try to. Again, it's all in bold, all-cap print, and again, there's a lot of, like, aircraft lingo. But there was some incredible consistency between these reports. There's similarity to what happened over Scotland last week. And furthermore, that hot term missile. You wouldn't believe how often that comes up in these reports. Listen to this one, for instance. On a descent into SLC, let's see, at approximately 9,500 feet, we spotted something around 200 feet below us. I pulled our aircraft up and to the right and missed the object. Couldn't tell if it was an aircraft or a balloon, but it was dark blue in color and bigger than a basketball. Now get this, I'm going to skip ahead because they say, the co-pilot and I simultaneously saw what appeared to be a drop military style, this is what they just say in the report, a tank or a missile. The object appeared to be two-tone blue, bullet-shaped with one winglet extending from each side. Very interesting, but they use that term, they say missile. Again, that the general description in this report says bullet-shaped with one winglet extending from each side. Okay, let's skip ahead to a couple of others. This one's a good one. About 25... let's see here, nautical miles due east of, and they give, you know, some sort of an abbreviation for a location at about 12,500 feet. I caught a second glimpse of something. This isn't the same report. This is a different report, but they say a second glimpse of something going directly beneath the aircraft. At first, I thought it was another aircraft, but I didn't see any wings. So I asked air traffic control if they showed any aircraft that had just passed beneath me. They said that there was no such object in the area. Think again, what happened over Scotland last week. Radar hadn't detected this object. Now listen to what they say. I asked if there was anyone flying any aircraft nearby and if they had seen anything, but I was told no, that they hadn't seen anything. What I saw appeared to be a missile. Again, this is the term they use. The object was gray, had a round nose, and was cylindrical. It appeared to be traveling very fast. I did not see any contrail, although there was a layer of clouds beneath the object and my line of sight. I thought about it for a minute or so and concluded it looked more like a missile than anything else. Okay, let's move on to another report. And again, it's difficult to get the dates because of the lingo that they use. It appears this next one may have taken place around March of 1997. This is incredible. After a rocket or missile, what appeared to be a rocket or a missile, climbed through or past our altitude, it appeared to level off slightly or flatten its trajectory somewhat. The object was moving extremely fast, was highly visible, and was sighted by other aircraft that were flying nearby. I reported the incident as I was witnessing it. And then they leave off in the report, please follow up and contact me in reference to this. It is a very serious matter that needs immediate attention. They describe this thing, they say, another company aircraft, they'd stated that they had also seen what they described as being a rocket or a missile nearby. The actual rocket body was not visible, but the trailing smoke was thick and made the rocket sighting easy to see. The rocket climbed to the left and then began to level off. You know, again, you look through a lot of these sorts of reports and things like this. Again, by definition, these would be what we would call UFOs, okay? Because the pilots who'd seen these at the time, they couldn't identify them. They were afraid that they were seeing rockets or missiles or something along those lines. They couldn't identify what these things were, but they nonetheless made the report. And I think that, again, in this instance, you don't have to say that there are little green men buzzing around out there to wonder what in the heck our pilots are seeing out there. What are these things? Do you remember the stories? Now, this is another tie-in, and this goes back to the Second World War. Do you remember back during the Second World War? It was right after the Second World War in parts of Europe where they described what were sometimes called ghost rockets. These stories were just incredible. And essentially the idea was that in different parts of Europe, there were many sightings of what could be described as being missile-like objects. Okay. And these phantom rockets, these ghost rockets, if you would, were often seen streaking through the air. I think one exploded in a lake somewhere, maybe near Scandinavia. And people wondered, well, who was using this technology? What were these things? Who had actually designed them, and for what purpose were they used? Ghost rockets, okay, they were seen in Scandinavia, they were seen in parts of Sweden, all these different countries nearby. The first reports of ghost rockets were apparently made on February 26th, 1946, which was, get this, that was more than a year before Kenneth Arnold saw flying saucers in the United States, and that was more than a year before the alleged UFO crash at Roswell. About 2,000 sightings were logged between May and December of 1946, with peaks on the 9th and 11th of August of the same year. 200 sightings were verified with radar returns, so they knew something was actually flying around up there. They just don't know precisely what it was. And authorities recovered physical fragments on at least a couple of occasions that were attributed to these alleged ghost rockets. The Swedish military had given opinions about this. The Greek government had investigated these things. They wanted to know who might have been utilizing this kind of technology back around 1946. It's very interesting. Were there actual military bodies that were engaging in the testing of different kinds of technologies and things along these lines? Was there something else going on? A lot of people have utilized these kinds of reports and have referenced them in relation to early or maybe precursors to modern UFO reports. But I think it's kind of interesting when you start seeing that there are reports of what we would, again, call UFOs, because we don't know what they are. We don't know whose they are. They are unidentified, and they're objects, and they're certainly flying, but we just can't account for where they come from. And yet these technologies appear to be something that is known to exist. It doesn't seem to be something particularly exotic. But again, you know, within the last few years, these sorts of reports of what we would, I guess, liken to being ghost rockets have continued, and they are reported by commercial airline pilots and no doubt military pilots just as well. And there seems to be a lack of data in terms of what precisely these things actually are. I mean, it just blows my mind. What are they? It's fascinating to me. You know, Tyler, you were reading over the report before we went to air. You know, and I have to just say, I mean, you know, when you read that, what does that make you think? I mean, are there missiles being fired in airspace over the United States that people don't know about? Are they, in every instance, misidentification of objects? And what do we say about the reports where we have pilots in separate planes, like that last report, where they all describe seeing something that they said, yes, it did indeed look like a rocket or a missile?
Yeah, it's strange because some of the reports mention that all these sightings came from people who were trained in aviation,
right,
and had license to pilot commercial aircraft. I think one of them even described it, their response as tactical maneuvers and defensive plays. So these people, their reports are talking about things that they're identifying as missiles or rockets, or in some cases trying to rationalize as science projects gone wrong.
Right, yeah.
But the fact that there are no answers tells me it's likely some type of military craft or weapon or something, because there are no answers. And usually that means,
yeah, the lack,
you know,
of,
if they were really interested in finding out what it was and it was some novel thing, then I think that there would be
more. But something potentially dangerous as well. Yeah, exactly. There would be a lot more said about it. And I guess the silence may be indicative of there being something else going on. But, you know, again, that you have to wonder, is this something that would be potentially dangerous? I mean, literally, what are described as rockets shooting around? In the incident last week with Scotland, there's a pretty definitive answer. But I found it very interesting that, digging a little deeper, there are plenty of other instances out there where the clear answers just aren't there. And so we're left to wonder, as we often do, well, what are we dealing with? You know, are there secret technologies that are being utilized in our midst? And how much of a stretch would it be to say that that's the case, knowing that, well, there's secret technology being utilized to listen in on your telephone conversations right now? You know, there are things that go on behind the veil of secrecy in this country. I'm sorry, it's just the truth. Back to the program. It is the final segment of tonight's episode of the Grayling Report. It's kind of hard to believe we've made it this far and so fast. Boy, sometimes the time just flies faster than a ghost rocket. You know, it's interesting because there were so many different investigations into those early reports of the ghost rockets. The Swedish, the British, the U.S. military, they all looked into this because they were really concerned about whether there might be objects that often were described as being missile-like or rocket-like, but that left no exhaust trail. Again, you know, in the more modern reports that we were just looking at, a lot of the time these things that look like missiles or something along those lines, or at very least cylindrical objects, they don't appear to leave any kind of an exhaust trail, or sometimes move too slowly to actually be a verifiable, bona fide rocket. Sometimes they traveled and maneuvered in formation, and sometimes they were completely silent, these objects that were seen over parts of Europe following the Second World War. The crashes weren't uncommon, but they were almost always into lakes. There were stories about these things seen shooting into lakes and exploding and things like that. Reports were made of objects crashing into a lake and then propelling themselves across the surface before sinking, as well as a few ordinary crashes from which maybe inconclusive debris was recovered. It's very strange, and again, it remains one of the perplexing aspects of the UFO mystery that, again, I think warrants serious interest, especially if there's a potential that those kinds of things are still going on to this day. Now, on October 10th, 1946, there was a Swedish Defense Staff publicity statement that had been made about the ghost rocket observations. They said, most observations are vague and can be treated very skeptically, but in some cases, clear, unambiguous observations have been made that cannot be explained as natural phenomena, Swedish aircraft, or simply the imagination on part of the observer. Echo, radar, and other equipment registered readings, but gave no clue as to the nature of the objects. It was all stated that fragments alleged to have come from missiles were nothing more than ordinary slag. It's very, very, very strange. You know, and again, I think that probably even the majority of ufologists out there who make it their business to know these kinds of things, probably, maybe in a lot of instances, they don't know where to look, and so this kind of information about more modern reports kind of falls to the wayside. So it's very interesting how something that was a bit tenuous, what is believed to be a remote-controlled, helium-filled shark toy flying underneath a Scottish airliner led to, at very least our interest in looking at modern reports of what might categorically be described as ghost rockets. I mean, what are those things?
You know what it reminds me of, and I'm not sure if this thing was debunked or not, maybe I just didn't keep up on the specific story, but Micah, do you remember the video? And it was was it filmed from the ISS or a satellite image or something like that, and it was like the little UFO, not saying extraterrestrial, just an unidentified flying object buzzing out through space, and then there was the flash, and then you see the little UFO guy flip around, and then it looks like there's some sort of projectile that flies in the path that it was in. Do you remember this?
Oh, I do. Yeah, and it's a very well-known piece of footage, but I think that the general explanation for that is that you got to keep in mind there are a lot of little bits of debris, especially ice and things like that, that are floating around out there in Earth orbit where the operations of the ISS and of course, some of our spacecraft take place. What is believed is that phenomenon, what we saw in the footage there, can be explained as thrusters causing ice particles and things along those lines to move, so that what we see is an object that appears to change course, followed by another object moving very quickly toward it. This would be explained as thrusters causing those objects to move, which gave the appearance of a changing course of an object much further away.
Right.
That's the official explanation for that instance. And I don't remember the actual name of the video, but people can find it. If you go online, you could probably look at missile fired at UFO. You'd find that on YouTube. And I'm sure that that would probably bring it up. So, you know, and speaking of space, there was this funny story that I want to bring up real quick Tyler, you'd send along today. If you want to own a little piece of heaven, it's yours, starting at apparently around 1999 per acre on the moon. If you prefer, you can buy property on Venus or Mercury as well. Mercury is nice this time of year. Is this actually true? They say that the man sailing these lots is Dennis Hope, founder and owner of Lunar Embassy Corp. of Gardnerville, Nevada, which claims to hold the property rights to several heavenly bodies. How many? He says 9 altogether. When we started, Pluto was still considered a planet, and he claims that you can purchase, for $19.99, a plot of land on the moon.
Be sure to bring plenty of air.
Yeah, you have to bring a BYOA.
Yep.
Bring your own air. That's pretty funny. Now, that was in 1968. At the time, Hope was unemployed, hadn't worked for a year, and was getting divorced and lived in San Francisco. Things looked bad, and he remembers thinking that if only he had property, things might be better. And then I saw the moon. I thought, well, there's a lot of property up there. He discovered that little stood between him and ownership, hardly more than stood between proud Cortez and, say, Mexico, once the intrepid Spaniard had taken a shine to it. So Hope consulted what was and is the governing document of outer space, the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and other celestial bodies, known for short as our Outer Space Treaty. While the treaty explicitly forbids the nations of Earth from making terrestrial claims on other planets, it does not address what claims might legally be made by private companies, a possibility not imagined in 1968. So, apparently it says Hope asked three lawyers whether or not he could assert development rights to the moon, and two told him that they didn't know. The third said, oh sure, why not? Hope was off and running, and he has never received, he says, a challenge to his right to sell space real estate from any terrestrial government. Tyler, are you going to buy a plot of land on the moon?
I mean, it's kind of a deal. You get an acre. And, I mean, in the news recently, people are paying extraordinary amounts of money to take a one-way trip to Mars as if they're ever going to be able to actually reap the benefit of what they're paying for.
Yeah, so, exactly.
The moon's a lot closer, you know.
And you might at least be able to make
it home.
A
deal.
Yeah, you might at least make it home from the moon.
I'll say if a singularity occurs and I become this, like, complete just robo-Caleb, then I'm probably going to hang out on the moon quite a bit. Just going to chill out on the dark side, listen to some Pink Floyd.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's something I've always wanted to do. And there are so many in our circles, you know, who have said, you know, I hope maybe one day, whether it be traveling via ghost rocket or the privatized kind of space exploration aircraft that we hear about that, you know, Richard Branson and Virgin have been working on and all this, I would love to be able to go to the moon one day. You know, we wouldn't be able to have the thrill of being able to say that we were the first ones there, but it would truly be incredible to be able to stand on the lunar surface and look back at terra firma. You know, to have that Tom Hanks experience where you lift your thumb and you're able to cover the entire planet and realize how small we all really are. I've always thought that would be fascinating. And the thing is that although we've been to the moon, despite what some would claim is the official withholding of information about what exists on the dark side of the moon, you know, there really is, very little information about what we really do know about the entirety of what may be found on the moon. We've even talked in the past on programs about, archaeological studies, which have alluded to the idea that, when we get up there to the moon, we may not find, life. We may not find anything, you know, truly compelling in terms of there being a living organism or a lunar base, but that does not remove the possibility that you may find what would amount to being junk that has drifted from other spacefaring civilizations to the moon and which may be found there. We may, once we travel to the moon, find evidence. And the reason for this, of course, would be that, you know, relative to the size and, of course, the gravitational pull of the moon, an object that would land on the moon might not be destroyed as quickly as something entering Earth's atmosphere.
I know what you're going to find. Cheese.
You're going to find cheese, exactly. But it is an interesting question. I mean, would we be more likely to find extraterrestrial artifacts, maybe even something hundreds of thousands of years old that's just been laying around up there on the moon? And once we do have the ability to get to the moon, to, you know, to spend more time there, perhaps even colonize, you know, and create what we'd call, you know, lunar bases. We've talked about this in science fiction for decades, but we're nearing the actual technology that's going to get us there and do it. And once we do, what will we find up there? Will there be evidence of extraterrestrials? But rather than, like Richard C. Hoagland and people say, an ancient lunar archaeological dig or something along those lines, what if we actually find a little bit of debris, a little piece of trash, something, you know, that had been on the thruster of some, you know, ET vehicle literally thousands of years ago? We'll have no way of being able to determine, aside maybe from, you know, carbon dating and things like that, what exactly we're looking at. But what if we found evidence of something that was not our own and we found it on the moon? I mean, these are possibilities. You never know.
I would imagine that finding some sort of artifact or debris or something like that would probably be more likely found on a planet like Mars rather than the moon.
Well, I don't know, though, because, again, you know, I think that the question here is, one of relative to the size of a planet and thus the gravity that it exerts. You know, when an object starts entering the atmosphere, you know, it's, of course, you know, it also has a question of whether there is a, you know, an atmosphere on this planet or planetoid. The moon is a very unique environment, whereas on planet Earth, anything before it even kind of gets close to Earth, it's going to, you know, if it's a small object or something, you know, presumably what we would call an extraterrestrial artifact, you know, a little piece of, you know, piece of trash floating around out there in space, once it hits Earth's atmosphere, it's going to burn up pretty quickly, like most meteors do as they enter Earth's atmosphere, you know. And even then, a lot of the actual meteorites, the actual space rocks that hit Earth, are often the result of explosions that take place, okay, when a meteor is actually entering Earth's atmosphere, and whether there are gases being heated within the object or the object is literally just burning apart when it fragments, explodes, or otherwise falls apart, you know, little shards are what often hit the ground. And I read a recent study that believes that it has proof of these sorts of meteorite shards that were found at the Tunguska blast of 1908, which seemed to confirm that whatever actually exploded over Tunguska was in fact a meteorite, which is the long-held theory. But again, you know, the point is that unlike here on Earth, when a space object, rock, or whatever else it may be, is going to enter and it's going to burn up probably entirely before it even gets close to the Earth, it may not be the same in every instance on the moon. And so there could be, in that instance, a greater likelihood that we would find something anomalous up there on the lunar surface. You know, again, we know a lot about the moon. We've been there. A lot of people already consider that claimed territory. You know, just
I'm
like
just thinking if some lonely space pirate from eons ago dropped his hammer or chisel. Not that he would probably be using that if he was going through space, but, well, you know, dropped some sort of iPhone on Mars.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Is, I mean, it would, if it had been a spacefaring nation, this would have to be, and I say if it had been, because who knows what could have come and gone in the last several hundreds of thousands of years that we never were made privy of. You know, it could have been a civilization that appeared and they were gone in terms of, you know, the great chronological passage of time on a universal scale. They could already be gone, but evidence of those civilizations. You know, the challenge would be to find one that's actually still existent and we make contact, but we may find evidence of intelligent life that maybe has long come and gone, and that evidence could be closer to home than many of us would ever even really think to look in most instances. That's going to have to do it for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Always probing the fascinating possibilities here on the program. And if you'd like to reach us, you can always email us info@graylianreport.com. We'd love to hear from you about what's on your mind and what you'd like to hear on the program. And whether or not we hear from you, we'll probably hear from somebody after all the conspiratorial surveillance state talking we've done tonight. At very least, we'll know that they're out there listening. Who knows who all is out there listening? We know you're out there listening, and we thank you for doing so. And therefore, on behalf of all of us here at the Grayling Report, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Matt Oakley, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, the voice of the mountains, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends. And until next time, as always, stay strange. We'll talk to you soon.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.